Welcome, 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 beloved listeners to LNL. You may recall that when we had a photo finish election in the United States a while ago with two putative presidents in Bush and Gore, it took the Supreme Court to hand the crown to the Republican. Well, we've got a pretty tight election in Indonesia, and in just a minute we shall be discussing matters arising. And I want to then complicate the issues of surrounding Sri Lanka, Australia and the boats by actually talking to some prominent Sri Lankans. We'll be meeting with a former ambassador to the United Nations and a former vice president of the UN Human Rights Council from Colombo, and also to a Sri Lankan MP and former secretary to the Ministry of Disaster Management and Human Rights, and, yes, with a spokesperson for the Tamils. Now, the quick count, as you've heard in the news, shows that Widodo will become the second directly elected president in Indonesia's history, but his opponent, Subianto, has also claimed victory or is not conceding defeat. So what's in store for the incoming president of the world's third largest democracy, most populous Muslim country, and the largest economy in Southeast Asia? And add to the problems that the next president will face, any president will face, the appalling state of infrastructure, education, health, widespread corruption, and so on. So it's an uphill battle. And, of course, if you're listening to the repeat, more will have occurred on this fast-moving story. Joining me in the South Bank studio is Tim Lindsay. Tim is director of the Centre for Indonesian Law, Islam and Society in the University of Melbourne. And Tim's tomes include Constitutional Law in Indonesia. Yuli Ismatono is the deputy chief editor of the English edition of Tempo magazine and joins me online from Jakarta. And Elizabeth Pisani is an epidemiologist, a journalist, and director of Taniata Limited. It's a public health consultancy, and Elizabeth is the author of Indonesia Etc., Exploring the Improbable Nation. Tim, both candidates, or we seem to have two candidates who are not conceding defeat. What happens next?
Well, in fact, Joko Widodo, or Jokowi, has claimed victory. He did so fairly early on. Prabowo has given a somewhat lukewarm response in which he doesn't quite claim victory, mentions victory, and certainly doesn't concede. But I think it's pretty clear that Jokowi has won. The quick counts are fairly reliable. In the past, they've been accurate to about 1%. And they're all, except for the really dodgy ones that lack credibility, all the credible quick counts are showing a victory of around about 5 points or so. So it does seem pretty clear that Jokowi will be the next president, whatever Prabowo's camp does, and I expect they will probably do quite a lot to try and overturn that. But there will not actually be a formal official result until 9 August when the Electoral Commission announces it. And we can expect there to be a large number of disputed return cases. There are already allegations of fraud. Whether or not fraud's taken place, those allegations are pretty inevitable. Prabowo's campaign has been an aggressive, well-funded, well-organised one, and notable for unparalleled levels of black campaigning and smearing in a way that's never happened before in Indonesian elections. So whether or not fraud's taken place, it will be alleged, and that will go to the Constitutional Court to decide.
Now, Yuli, I must say that members of the media rather enjoy political chaos. It's such an interesting time to be in the trade. You're going to be a very busy person.
Yes, indeed. But as Tim Lindsay very, very aptly put out, I think it's very clear who the winner is. What we're going to be busy reporting is in the next few weeks when the uncertainty over this quote-unquote disputed victory will take place. I think in the intervening time, there will be all kinds of, Tim Lindsay mentioned dark campaigning. I think it will be a continuation of that until the official results come out. We will have a lot to write about, yes.
When you look out your window, Yuli, are you seeing dancing in the streets?
There have been dancing in the streets by the Jokowi camp. Yes, they have been celebrating. The other side has been quite muted, actually. Not very much of celebrating. In fact, they're looking rather glum. So the celebration has been quite one-sided.
Now, let's look briefly, Yuli, if we could, at this mammoth election campaign. 187 million registered Indonesians voted. I mean, the logistics of this are awe-inspiring.
It's not the first time that we've had this, such elections. This is the third. So, with all its faults, the Election Commission has done it before, and we still have many faults, but we are able to do it.
Well, it's greatly to your credit, and it's also, it comes as a surprise, at least to me, to learn that 9 out of 10 have a mobile, 1 in 3 have a smartphone. You are a very technically savvy nation.
The social media has played a very big role in the elections, negatively and positively, and that I think that has changed the nature of the elections. This year's election, as compared to the first two, and of course, as you know, a great percentage of the voters this time around has been the first-time voters because of the age, the 17 years. This is the first time that they will be voting in the past 5 years, since the last election.
Elizabeth, you were at the initial campaign rallies where voters told you about handouts, prizes, inducements, and I found this amusing, how they rated contestants by the quality of the food. Please explain.
Well, you turn up to a rally of this contestant and he gives you a jilbab if you're a woman, a hijab in his colours, transport, obviously, and some kind of a lunch. So it'll be either a chicken rice box or it'll be a nasi bungkus, a wrapped up rice and some kind of dishes with it. And people are very funny about which campaigns they go to all of the campaigns, obviously, and they wear the campaign colours because they get the free T-shirts, they get the free jilbabs. They often get cash payments also just for turning up. And the funniest thing, actually, is the local transport drivers, the guys who have minibuses, for example, and even rickshaws. They get paid, number one, for putting banners on their BMOs, their minibuses, number two, for bringing in passengers, and then they get paid again for parking in an inconvenient spot and causing a traffic jam because the contestants want to look as though they've got a massive, massive rally going. So the guys are like, I just love it. I get to sit around and smoke all afternoon, you know, and I get paid
$25. Well, Elizabeth, I must say it makes our election proceedings sound rather tepid. And, of course, our vote is compulsory. You have to vote in Australia or you get fined. You spoke to thousands of ordinary potential voters who admired Prabowo for being firm, and they muttered approvingly about his iron fist. And yet we now learned it wasn't sufficiently ironish. What do they have to say about Jokowi?
I think that what's interesting about their attitude to Prabowo is, yes, we want an iron fist, and that's the first reaction that you get from people. But actually, if you hang around and, you know, sleep on their floor for a couple of days and cook in their kitchen with them, people say, you know, we need an organized leader. We need a well-organized orang yang tegas, a person who is firm. But we really don't want to go back to being told what to do all the time. We really don't want to go back to a central government that is completely lacking in transparency to us, where there's no accountability. And this is much more the case outside of Java. So, of course, Indonesia is a rather unbalanced nation to the extent that 60% of the population live in 7% of the landmass, just the one island of Java. And in the other areas of Indonesia, this reform period has seen a huge decentralization, which has allowed for the rise of local politicians who are not part of the national machinery. And in fact, Jokowi is one of those. He came up as a mayor of his own hometown and then got onto the national stage by running for governor of Jakarta. So people outside of Java have a great deal to lose by going back to a Suharto-style centralized government, which is what that iron fist of Prabowo's promised.
Tim, quite a lot of the pundits, both in Jakarta and indeed in Australia, will be eating their hats because we were led to believe that, you know, that David could not defeat Goliath, given Goliath's marvellous control of the instruments of power and the money to run a very sophisticated campaign.
Well, I'm not really sure who is David or Goliath in this one, because Jokowi started off as the clear favourite with a lead more than 10. At one point, I think it was closer to 20 over Prabowo, and it was really his to lose. And what Prabowo did was, and his campaign, which involved imported US spin doctors who've been working for years with vast amounts of money and some pretty canny image management, what they managed to do was reinvent a cashiered general who had admitted to abducting and torturing students and is implicated in massacres in East Timor and Papua, to reinvent him as a viable candidate, and using social media and saturation advertising to the point that you would find money occasionally with his name stamped on it, they reversed it. So they closed that lead and brought it down to just 5 points in the end. So what Jokowi was up against was a massive exercise, highly organised, Republican-style
effort. So what are the top three policies, and I use three as an arbitrary figure, that the people of Indonesia want from a new president, Tim?
Well, this has been largely a policy vacuum. This boiled down to a personality competition. But behind it was a bigger question, which I think was just explained by Elizabeth, which is, in a sense, voters were really making a decision about where Indonesia goes after 15 years of democratization and 10 years of what turned out to be fairly lackluster leadership by President Yudhoyono. And the big question was, do we keep muddling on, trying to fix up the model we've got, or do we make a radical decision to go for some extreme solution involving what would ultimately work out to be a reversion back to Suharto with his former son-in-law in the palace? And he even started wheeling out his former wife, Suharto's daughter, and rumours started to spread that he'd remarry her if he got back into the palace. So the choice they were making was really not about about policies. It was about personalities, and linked to those personalities, where Indonesia goes. And it looks like, by a very narrow margin, they've chosen muddling through.
You mentioned the parallels with the US Republicans' method of campaigning. Is there a hint of the Obama in the winner?
Oh, yes, he's often been compared to Obama, and it's extraordinary that there is really quite a facial resemblance. One difference is that he really lacks the charisma and rhetorical presence that Obama has on the podium. Jokowi is a very good grassroots campaigner with his blusukan drop-ins, where he appears in food stalls or in offices and talks to people. But on the stage, he was generally outperformed by Prabowo, who is a real showman. But like Obama, he's had to face his own equivalent of the birthers. Prabowo's black campaign included allegations that Jokowi was secretly ethnically Chinese, that he was a covert Christian, and so forth.
But this is straight from
even though he was born overseas.
This is straight from the Republican playbook. This is fully imported.
And indeed, the two American spin doctors that were bought out were associated with the Republican campaign.
Yeah. How about that? Now, Yuli, before we discuss the challenges ahead for your new president, what, if anything, will be SBY's greatest legacy? We've heard Tim saying that it wasn't a particularly distinguished administration, but did it achieve much at all?
I think that the campaign, both on the part of Jokowi and Prabowo, is actually an attack, or they want something different from what they've been having in the last 8 years. So basically, they want something different from the complacency, from the non-action from SBY.
Yuli, I completely accept and understand that, but did SBY notch some achievements up?
You know, it's very difficult for me to bring up any, because the important ones, like withdrawing the subsidy, the fuel subsidy, he never did. And he did not stand up to pluralism when the minorities were attacked, whether they were Christians, whether they were Muslims. I will say this, that he did introduce Indonesia to the world globally by joining in the different initiatives, such as the Open Government Partnership, the Extractive Industry Transparency Initiative, which put Indonesia on the map towards openness and transparency. But other than that, I'm sorry, but I voted for SBY, but in the end, he turned out to be a big disappointment.
Now, Elizabeth, we're looking ahead at a complex policy-making process, and for his part, the new boss has identified religious intolerance and ethnic differences as serious social issues in Indonesia and is calling for a mental revolution. What is a mental revolution?
Campaign rhetoric is what that is. But I think that one of the things that's interesting to me about what Tim was saying, the Republican spin doctors, drawing that parallel with the Republicans, is that they did exactly what the Republicans also always do, which is consistently underestimate the sophistication of the electorate. The Indonesian electorate is incredibly sophisticated. They understand the issues very well. And the mental revolution that's called for is get down to work, let's make our bureaucracy function. Indonesia is not lacking in good plans and it's not lacking in good laws. What it's lacking in is implementation of any of those plans and laws. And I think that one of the reasons that Jokowi played well with the electorate is that they do have some confidence that he has, albeit on quite a small scale in his hometown of Solo and then just for a couple of years in Jakarta, he has shown that he actually can begin to make the bureaucracy work, that he can begin to crack down on petty bribery within the bureaucracy, that he can make people come to work on time and do their jobs when they're there. And just doing that would make a huge difference to people's daily lives in Indonesia.
I'm looking forward to hearing you in Sydney next month, when you be at the Opera House talking to the topic Corruption Makes the World Go Round. And you point out that in some parts of Indonesia, corruption in effect serves as the glue that keeps an otherwise fractious country together.
I tend, when I talk about the glue, to use the word patronage rather than corruption. And again, I come back to the
sophistication of... Who's your spin doctor, Elizabeth?
Well, no, I think there is an important difference. And I come back to the sophistication of the Indonesian electorate. If one of their local leaders, their bupati, the district leader, or their mayor, is outright stealing, if he is taking money from the local budget and flying to Singapore and spending that money on drugs and hookers, which happens, they throw him out of power. That happens. If, on the other hand, what he's doing is taking the local budget and doling it out to slightly inefficient contractors who are building local roads because they supported his campaigns, well, people say, well, we didn't have any road here before, and now we've got a bad road because it was made by a local contractor, but that's part of the process.
And, so of course, it's a part of the process in the United States of America as well, isn't it?
Probably in every country.
Yes, it's sometimes more cleverly camouflaged.
And also, in some places, it's just legalized. And what's interesting is that Indonesia, since the reforms and the new constitution, has really quite strong laws against this. Again, none of them are ever enforced. But in the US, they do the same thing, don't even call it corruption.
I've got to ask you this before I go back to Tim. I think you're very much enjoying what's happening at the moment. You think it's... you're happy, aren't you?
I think it's great. I tell you, I'm a great follower of the Australian National University's blog, New Mandala, which is one of the best sources of scholarship on Asia. And they asked me to do a blog post. I was like, oh, I don't know anything, all these smart academics. And I wrote a post saying Indonesians are not idiots, saying, you know, really, I think that common sense will out in this election. This was just about a week ago. And I got this barrage from people I respect very much saying, you're out of touch and this and that. And so I have to say, I'm having quite a happy I told you so moment, because it would have been, it was a real possibility that Prabowo would get elected. And then you'd have to come to the conclusion that Indonesia would have got the government it deserved. And that would have been a very sad outcome.
Back to you, Tim. When we last spoke in February, as I recall, we looked at how Jokowi could be just the ticket for the job because he'd done such a fine job as governor of Jakarta. Talk to that briefly.
Well, he has a reputation for careful policy formation, for paying attention to detail. He's been pretty successful on welfare-oriented work such as housing, identity cards, health cards that give access to health services and education and so forth. So in terms of hands-on policies that really directly assist the poor, he has a really, in the Indonesian context, a pretty spectacular track record. Now, the issue is that was in a small town in central Java and then in the capital. Can he expand that out across the nation in a quite different role? And can he do it in what is actually, contrary to popular perception, a fairly weak office? Because, in fact, the strongest body constitutionally and politically in Indonesia is the legislature. And the president can command, but the legislature implements. And his coalition will command around about 40% of the legislature. So whether he can get his program through a legislature that he not only has a plurality, but a legislature which will have a very large portion led or associated with Prabowo that will be setting out to undermine his agenda, at least early on.
Might we see another echo of the United States with a very powerful opposition that just simply says no constantly, as they do to Obama?
I think that will be a problem early on, but you have to remember that one of the big differences between Indonesia and America, and of course Australia for that matter, is that coalitions in Indonesia are written on water. Then every vote in the legislature is a sort of conscience vote, or rather an unconscionable vote, because it's very common for people to cross the floor to vote against their own party. And my expectation is that after a while, he will start building more workable pseudo or informal coalitions that will let him govern. But I think, you know, he was only supported by a narrow majority, and he will have to demonstrate that he can do better than Yudhoyono has to satisfy the concerns that Yuli expressed. And if he doesn't manage to do that in the first 12 months, I think he will be, in fact, maybe even less than it, maybe the first 6 months, then I think he will really face instability. He's really going to be under a lot of pressure to show that he deserves the office, given how close it's been.
You were somewhat cross with me earlier when I talked David and Goliath, but a lot of the conservative commentary in Australia has come from people who didn't want this outcome, and who do see him as a rank amateur compared to the glossy professional. So you know, this is still in some ways a culture shock.
Well, I think Australia would have been in for a very rude awakening if tomorrow morning they'd found Prabowo had won. Prabowo is a very volatile and unstable individual. Even during the election campaign, he was involved in scuffles and punch-ups. He has a track record of human rights abuse, of explosive temperamental behaviour. And all of this would have been extremely difficult. There were already reactions from investors when it looked like he was going to win. So, you know, I think that sort of enthusiasm for Prabowo would have been very misplaced.
Tim, you've been witnessing enthusiasm for a visiting Japanese Prime Minister whose ideological background is, to say the least, unpleasant.
Prabowo-esque.
Yes, it's amazing, really, how flexible Australia can be. I wonder whether there'll be any changes in attitude on the contentious issue of boat people, Tim.
Well, I think that that is likely to be a point of tension between Australia and Indonesia for the same reason that I just gave for the difficulties Jokowi will probably face in the next 6 months. And that is that because it's been a narrow victory, he will be under a great deal of pressure to win legitimacy from you know, half the population. And the campaign was largely run on the basis of nationalist credentials. Both Jokowi and Prabowo asserted that they would respond firmly to any intrusions on Indonesian sovereignty, air or water. Jokowi, unlike Prabowo, said he would negotiate and engage in dialogue first, but he was also quite clear that if that didn't work, he would respond, as he said, firmly. So I think he could not act in the same with the same sort of tolerant and very indulgent response typified Yudhoyono's attitude towards Australia, despite the wiretaps, and that we're likely to see Operation Sovereign Borders resulting in a few slapdowns for Australia. I don't think that it will be as easy to send back boats and orange lifeboats under Jokowi as it was under Yudhoyono.
Our next story, dear guests, is Sri Lanka, Australia and the boat. So I'm going to stick on this topic, if you don't mind. Elizabeth, have you detected any interest in this issue within Indonesia amongst the punters?
Absolutely not. I mean, except in the islands that are closest to Australia, where anyone who speaks English occasionally gets a gig going and translating for some Afghans who wash up on shore, islands like Sumba, for example. It's really not something that has exercised the Indonesians, to my knowledge, in the way that it exercises the average punter in Australia. It's not really on the radar screen of anyone outside of the Jakarta policy elite, really, to my knowledge.
Yuli, how important will Megawati be backstage?
Well, there's a very warm relationship between Jokowi and Megawati, and he certainly respects him, her. And that has been the question in many of his critics. Is he going to be his own man, or will he be the puppet of Megawati? I think the general opinion is that, as he had said himself in this debate, I can be firm if I want to. And I think that he will be his own man, as he did when he was governor and he was in Solo. However, being the Javanese that he is, he will always, I don't think the word is defer, but certainly pay his respect and always consult with her. Now, he is a PDIP person, and he will have to always go back to Megawati. But how powerful her influence will be on him, I don't think we can say right now.
It's an exhilarating moment in Indonesian and indeed regional history, and I thank the three of you very much for your contribution. Yuli, Tim and Elizabeth. Yuli is Deputy Chief Editor of the English edition of Tempo. Tim Lindsay is Director of the Centre for Indonesian Law, Islam and Society at the Uni of Melbourne. Author of many books, including Constitutional Law in Indonesia, published by Hart. And Elizabeth Pisani's latest book is engagingly entitled Indonesia, Etc., Exploring the Improbable Nation, published by Granta. Next, as advertised, Australia, Sri Lanka and the votes, and aren't many votes in it. We're joined by three Sri Lankans to get their response to accusations of human rights violations, people smuggling, and the treatment of boat people in Australia. LNL on RN. Immigration Minister Morrison in Sri Lanka to attend the commissioning ceremony for those two customs patrol vessels gifted to the Sri Lankan government. But of course, there'll be much to talk about. 150 asylum seekers who continue to be on the high seas and an Australian customs vessel while their fate is decided in our High Court. Now, the Australian government not only depends on Colombo to stop the boats from leaving Sri Lankan shores, but is now accused of turning a blind eye to human rights violations in the island nation, where returned asylum seekers claim to be tortured by the Criminal Intelligence Department. Now, I'm going to talk to three Sri Lankans to get their responses to accusations of human rights violations, people smuggling, and the treatment of boat people in and around Australia. Joining me on the blower from Parliament House in Sri Lanka, where he is an MP, is Dr. Rajiva Wijesingra. Rajiva is a former secretary in the Ministry of Disaster Management and Human Rights in Sri Lanka. Dr. Dayan Jayateleka is Sri Lanka's former ambassador to the UN and, note this, former vice president of the UN Human Rights Council. And sitting opposite me in the studios here in Sydney is Dr. Victor Rajakulendran, chairperson of the Australian Federation of Tamil Associations. And my first question goes to the former ambassador, Dayan Morrison, discussing matters about asylum seekers. What is the Sri Lankan government likely to do with those who've been returned?
We have no evidence that the Sri Lankan government engages in torture or physical ill treatment of anyone who has been returned. As far as we know, what we can see from Sri Lankan television newscasts is that they are processed and then the law enforcement authorities try to figure out who it was who put them on the boats and for what purpose. That's what it looks like at the moment. But of course, scrutiny is a good thing. One has to keep an eye on what's going on. And the international scrutiny is not a bad thing.
Would you regard the Tamil refugees amongst their number as being in a more difficult situation, he said diplomatically?
Well, I would say that there is a significant degree of alienation and disaffection that many Tamil people feel towards the status quo in Sri Lanka, towards the Sri Lankan state in the post-war period. But again, it would be difficult to say that there is persecution as such, because just the other day, Deputy President of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa, paid a visit to the island, visited the north, spoke to the elected chief minister of the Tamil majority Northern Provincial Council, who had many political criticisms to make of the government of Sri Lanka. But this visit was on the invitation of the government of Sri Lanka. So it's difficult to believe that there is persecution in terms of, mass arrests. There are no mass arrests. There are no rubber bullets flying. There's no tear gas. There are no demonstrations, no shootings, no martial law. There is disaffection. So I don't think that the Tamil people are fleeing mass persecution, but I do think that they are unhappy, and they take any chance that they are offered by people smugglers to leave the island.
Okay, we'll come back to that shortly. Let's now introduce Rajiva. The asylum seekers are claiming they'll be tortured. Okay. I want to know, is it a crime to leave Sri Lanka without documentation, to leave Sri Lanka?
Violate the immigration and immigration laws. You're meant to leave through the usual legal process and have your passport stamped. So technically it's wrong. I don't really suppose that it's a crime in the sense of something that demands great punishment, but I think it's particularly important in the interests of all of us, both Sri Lanka and Australia, and indeed the world in general, to stop what's called people smuggling. Many of these people, as you know, are lots of them are Sinhalese. They look for greener pastures and they assume Australia is greener, God knows why. But in an attempt to get away, they are exploited by a lot of people. And I think it's very important to investigate the people involved. I was reading recently that Australia thinks perhaps some people of the security forces are also involved in people smuggling. I think it's vital that we should investigate this thoroughly and be quite hard in terms of punishing those who are exploiting these people by taking a lot of money from them and putting them into very dangerous circumstances. But I think the people themselves, as Diane said, I think it's up to the Sri Lankan government government to try to reduce the causes of disaffection, and indeed to develop situations in which Sri Lankans, both Sinhalese and Tamil, don't think that the best thing out of Sri Lanka is the sea leading out of it.
I now want to bring in Victor here in Sydney. Victor, let me remind you, dear listener, is the Secretary of the Australasian Federation of Tamil Associations. What I'm hearing sounds very sweet and reasonable.
Of course, that's always the case from Sri Lanka. I want to first address what my friend Dayan has said about Cyril Ramaphosa meeting the Northern Provincial Council Chief Vigneshwaran. Yesterday, on the same radio airwaves, Vigneshwaran came and gave a statement to George Avis. It's because life is intolerable in Sri Lanka. The very same army which fought the war and are now subject to international war crimes investigations are still in large numbers, positioned in the north and east. They have taken over every aspect of civilian life. They have taken over fertile lands of the people and are cultivating. They have brought in people,
Victor,
in large numbers.
I think the listeners of this program are very familiar with those charges. You don't want the asylum seekers returned to Sri Lanka. Would you be satisfied if they were sent to Manus Island or Nauru?
So if that is the Australian policy, that is the only way out for Australia, rather than sending and violating the convention to the persecutors themselves.
Our Foreign Minister, Victor Julie Bishop, said that people in Sri Lanka who were genuinely fleeing persecution could go to India rather than risk the dangerous journey to Australia.
Yes, many people have started their journey from India to Australia. They have been in Indian refugee camps for years and years, and they have no way of having a livelihood there. People have even spent a generation there. A second generation of kids have come up, and they can't have university education there. So
That's a problem for refugees around the world, of course, in almost every context. Rajiva, the Sri Lankan government has not directly commented, as far as I know, on whether Australia has acted lawfully. We agonised, many of us, over the legality of what we're up to. Do you see the recent developments as lawful?
Well, I think I don't understand Australian law as well as people in Australia do, but it does seem to me that the Australian government would not willfully do anything illegal. And of course, we've got a court there that will actually make its decisions on that. So let's leave those legal decisions to them. I'm more interested in what I would call the moral question. And I think one of the problems that we have here is the clear confusion between economic refugees, the vast majority of whom are indeed economic refugees, and the fact that so many of them, the majority, are Sinhalese, suggests that, you know, it's not a question of people fearing persecution. I think your foreign minister is very sensible to say if they really did fear persecution and torture, they could go to India. But the simple fact is that, as Mr. Kulenathan would know if he came to Sri Lanka, the vast majority of people in the north are not suffering the way they did during the war period. That is why, you know, I go up regularly. I run reconciliation committee meetings in every divisional secretariat. And at the beginning, in 2009-10-11, there were many more complaints. There are still complaints and difficulties. And as Diane said, I don't think we are doing enough to develop human resources, develop employment, to develop entrepreneurship up there. But certainly government has done a lot in infrastructural development, which has made the place much easier to live in. And as you know, Jaffna actually has a much higher per capita income than elsewhere. But there is a lot of political resentment, and this transfers particularly amongst the diaspora to, as it were, catch-all description of everyone who leaves as trying to escape from torture, which is just absolutely untrue. And I think the investigations, both by the Australians and indeed the British, have suggested that where individual cases are cited, the examination of what has happened shows that there is no question of torture or abuse. But I think it's up to you all to decide to act in accordance with your laws, and I believe your High Court has done exactly that.
Diane, as you're aware, we've not made any headway with asylum seekers in any country of origin. neither have they made any progress in relation to the transit countries, Indonesia, Malaysia. Sri Lanka, it seems, is the only country which has cooperated with Australia to stem the flow of boats. Why is this, do you think?
Well, clearly there is a security angle, a congruency in the views of the Australian government and the Sri Lankan government. There's a good bilateral relationship. Australia has, under this administration and even the previous one, not sought to isolate Sri Lanka. There's been a policy of constructive engagement on the part of Australia, which recognizes that in the Asia-Pacific region, if one is to make progress on anything in any country, you need a policy of constructive engagement. Now, the Sri Lankan policy towards helping controlling this flow is definitely a byproduct of Australia's pragmatic diplomacy towards Sri Lanka. I think that's what's happening. Many countries could just wash their hands off this and say, look, if people who are disaffected are leaving the country's shores, well, so much the better. And there would be much more to go around for those who remain. There have been countries in the third world that have taken that kind of stand, but the Sri Lankan state has not. And I think that's quite positive, that's quite helpful. It's something that Australia should encourage as a model of cooperation.
As you know, Victor, Australia had a very conservative prime minister who is now a born-again progressive, and Sri Lanka's consul general in Sydney wrote in The Australian that the aforementioned Prime Minister, ex-Prime Minister Fraser, doesn't help his standing by likening the return of Tamils to Sri Lanka to handing over Jewish refugees in Nazi Germany. Surely that is overstating the case by a couple of orders of magnitude.
I don't think so. Even he has gone to the extent of saying that transferring these asylum seekers to Sri Lankan naval vessel is equivalent to a piracy in the deep seas. So that was his stand. So he has outrightly criticized how the Australian government has handled this situation.
Do you, gentlemen in Colombo, I guess you both find Fraser's comments offensive, Diane?
Well, I've always been an admirer of the independent policies of Malcolm Fraser when he was Prime Minister, and he's been a conscience as an elder statesman, a conscience for Australia, but I think he's way over the top on this. I mean, he's trivializing in the first place these references to Nazi Germany. They trivialize the Holocaust. There are no concentration camps. What you have been a succession of elections in the north, which does have a very high concentration of military. And at every one of those elections, the anti-government Tamil National Alliance has won, whether it was at the provincial level or at the parliamentary level or even the municipal level. So I really don't think Nazi Germany is the right parallel. That's way over the top. He's trivializing the entire thing by that kind of rhetoric. And it's not very helpful.
LNL on RN, and we're having a discussion on Sri Lanka, Australia and the boats. Rajiva, there continues to be a heavy military presence in the north of your country since the ceasefire in 2009. Would you not agree that the response by some in the Tamil community, the anxieties in the diaspora, is valid when they say they cannot move around freely in the north of your country?
That's complete nonsense. I mean, I go up to the north very regularly, and so do many of my Tamil friends, and there really is no problem about moving about too much. I think one of the biggest problems we face is a complete lack of trust. You see, while I think Sri Lanka very correctly defeated the terrorist movement in Sri Lanka, and while I think most Tamils, including the TNA, would like now to settle down to greater political autonomy within a united Sri Lanka, Lanka, there are still elements in the diaspora that hanker after a separate state. Now, since they also command a lot of money and they send it here, there's a lot of disproportionate influence. And as you know, many of them speak from massive ignorance. They talk about, you know, the situation as it obtained earlier on. And therefore, they are trying to create further separatism, which of course makes the security forces more neurotic. I don't think there can be any question, sadly I have to say this, of the security forces being withdrawn. I think there can be much, much better cooperation between both the elected Tamil chief minister and the government and the forces, and I think both sides need to really grow up a bit.
Okay, let me offer Victor the right of reply from the diaspora.
Okay, he was talking about the chief minister again, you know, so he is he implied that he should cooperate with the central government. He took the oath. Instead of all the other Tamil officials taking oath from Tamils, he went to the president to take the oath when he was elected to the chief minister position. That is to create a reconciliation mode and cooperate with the president. But he himself is coming now and saying that the army is ruling the place and he can't take any action in the Northern Provincial Council without any interference from the central government.
As you know, Victor, it's been well over a decade of vigorous competition between the major political parties in this country and some fringe parties to see who can be toughest on refugees. And this Bob Carr said this week that he saw no evidence of abuse. And I quote, former Tamil Tigers, that is fighters using terrorist means, are now being rehabilitated, being employed, gainfully employed, being reintegrated into that community.
My reply to him is to go and read the 108-page document released by the most respected human rights activist, Jasmine Suka, who was one of the three members of the committee appointed by the UN Secretary General to get into the root of investigations of war crimes in Sri Lanka. In that conclusion, in that report, she concluded that there is ongoing rape, torture, and every human rights abuse in Sri Lanka.
Rajiva, is or are the issues we are discussing as a group now being widely discussed in your country? Is the arrival of our Australian contingent news in the city?
It has a very minor sort of reporting in the papers. I think, as Dan said, Sri Lanka does appreciate Australia's desire to engage. I think it is important for Australia to raise concerns with us, just as I think we should respond. But I also think it's important for people to look at evidence. I think Bob Carr was perfectly correct. I mean, Mr. Gulendran referred to Jasmine Suka's report. Jasmine Suka's report actually talks about the period during the war. There's a lot of condemnation of what they call violations on both sides. I've never heard any of the diaspora being tough on the Tigers, although some of the Tamil politicians in Sri Lanka are trying to actually be more balanced. And I think the situation now is entirely different. I mean, I fully agree that Mr. Vigneswaran's olive branches should be responded to by the government, and that's why I said both sides should grow up. But I think it's also very difficult for government to respond actively when you also have a chief minister who, though very nice and decent himself and certainly a moderate, occasionally goes into paroxysms of praise of Prabhakaran. Now, I don't particularly want to descend to the level of Malcolm Fraser in trying to make comparisons that are inappropriate, but I think someone who has been described as the most dangerous terrorist in the world, and he was ruthless about things like ethnic cleansing, about cutting off peace talks, using the peace talks to kill his fellow Tamils who were trying to be moderate, who assassinated the Tamil foreign minister of Sri Lanka, Dr. Neelam Thiruchelvam, who tried to broker a deal. For someone like that to be praised by Justice Vigneswaran is very sad. And although I think we should recognize he has political compulsions, I think we also need to recognize that that sort of thing makes the defense forces think, oh my God, this guy also might to move into separatist terrorism. I don't think he will. I think we need to understand him, understand the political pressures behind him, including sadly those of the diaspora who have so much money. But given all that, I think both sides need to grow up. And I think it's extremely sad that a very decent man like Mr. Kulendran can't understand that you cannot just, it takes two hands to clap.
Diane, before we wind this up, I'm curious about your president. He's been accused of enhancing his own power, using intimidation against critics, and having his entire family run the country. Is he an authoritarian leader using Western terminology?
Well, he does have occasional quasi-authoritarian moments, but this is a man who went against the advice of his own brother, the powerful securocrat, Mr. Gotabaya Rajapaksa, and chose to have an election to the Northern Provincial Council, which none of his predecessors were able to do, mainly because the Tigers were around, but even when they could, they didn't do it. He had this election, and the TNA, the Tamil National Alliance, scored 78%. Now, that's a place crawling with the military. They could have rigged the election if they wanted to, but they didn't. So I really wouldn't say that we're talking about an authoritarian leader. We are talking about a leader who seems to have a free run, because the main democratic opposition in the South, the United National Party, has been led by the same personality, Mr. Ranil Wickremesinghe, for 20 years. Now, the Australian Labour Party, as soon as it lost the election, changed its leadership. We have a democratic centre-right opposition which has had the same leader who keeps losing and has done so for 20 years.
This is the 20th anniversary. Yes, to be an Australian Prime Minister or indeed a Premier is to have the shelf life of yoghurt. Gentlemen, I thank you very much for your time. Dr. Rajiva Wijesinghe is a Sri Lankan Member of Parliament. Dr. Victor Rajakulendran is Chairperson of the Australasian Federation of Tamil Associations. And Dr. Diane Jayatilak is the former ambassador to the UN in Geneva. That's our program for today. On our next Another Election Watch segment, this time it's Turkey. For more information about any of our programs, please visit our website on abc.net.au/radionational and look in the programs for Late Night Live, or of course you can follow us on Twitter, me at philipadams_1, or the program at LNL on RN. That's it for now. Stick around on RN for the news, and I shall rejoin you in 23 hours.